we're talking about world religions still. We're talking about Buddhism still. So I'll give you a quiz. Just tell me what you remember from last week.
As far as
Buddhism. We talked about the origin of Buddhism, the founder of Buddhism. We talked
some about the circumstances of the origin of Buddhism.
Sure.
Buddha, good.
Yeah. That was the first thing we talked about. Buddha founded Buddhism.
It's a spin-off of Hinduism. It's Siddhartha, guy left Hinduism and was looking for a simpler, cleaner form of worship.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, obviously Buddhism is, we're going to, I think, ultimately decide today is an illegitimate religion. But in contrast to Hinduism, Buddhism is, I guess you could call it an improvement in many ways. Hinduism, you remember, is an extremely sensual, immoral religion on many, many levels, despite how it might be disguised in the 21st century. But, you know, that's the reality of Hinduism, extremely sensual, wicked in many, many ways. Buddhism, because of this Siddhartha Gautama, because of Buddha, we'll just call him, a lot of that changed. He eliminated the caste system. He eliminated the sacrifices. He eliminated a lot of the sensuality. And on a moral level, strictly on a moral level, I think we would very much agree with many of the teachings of Buddha. Sure. Yeah, we didn't talk about that a lot last week, but that is one feature of Buddhism. Is they consider life itself to be something very holy. And I was just reading this last night, actually. I'm assuming this is true. Of course, any experiences that any of us have had with Buddhism is with what we call Western Buddhism, which is really not real Buddhism. But apparently in legitimate Buddhism, Eastern Buddhism, all life is considered sacred. I think they're all vegetarians, actually. I don't think they kill animals to eat them. That's what I read last night from a Buddhist. But of course, Buddhism, I'm sure, is like Christianity in some ways. There's a lot of people who consider themselves Christians, but I wouldn't want them representing what I believe. You know what I mean? So what I read last night at least represents the opinions of one Buddhist. And so, yeah, as far as like the passivism, because they think all life is holy, they abstain from many, many things, including, you know, even killing animals. Yeah, just like Hinduism, the Buddhists believe in reincarnation. What is salvation as far as Buddhism is concerned?
Cease to exist.
Yeah, essentially. I looked up some more on, well, what's it called?
Nirvana.
Nirvana, right. So it's called Nirvana. And I looked up exactly what Nirvana means, and I don't remember the exact phrase that they used to describe it, but it means like to blow out a candle. And that actually kind of makes sense. They think your candle is blown out whenever you experience Nirvana. I got some mixed messages when I was reading more about Nirvana from the Buddhist perspective, because people criticized the idea of Nirvana because basically it seems to be saying that your reward for being good is to cease to exist. And apparently a Buddhist would maybe just say it a little bit differently. They would call it a degree of peace that is without explanation. But they also acknowledge that, you know, you're free from the emotions of this life. You're free from, you know, human thinking. And so it still seems to be, especially what Buddha himself taught, it seems that he was truly teaching that you're no longer reincarnated in any form, so you do cease to exist. What else did we learn last week about Buddhism? About when was it established? When did Buddha live? I wonder if my timeline's still...
After Hinduism was established.
That's good. Yeah.
500?
Yeah. Yeah, about 500. There's a couple different dates that people put on it. I think most people say 4th century B.C. or 5th century B.C., so 500 is in the ballpark. That's the number I would associate with it, is 500 B.C. So that's when Buddha actually lived. What are some of the other basic beliefs of Buddhism. Does anybody remember the Four Noble Truths of Buddhism? They're things that we would agree with. So here's the Four Noble Truths of Buddhism. Number one, human life is full of suffering. Two, suffering stems from cravings for pleasure and avoidance of pain. Three, suffering can be eradicated. And four, the path of freedom from suffering is the path of enlightenment. So exactly what number four means, I guess, is the idea of nirvana. As you approach a level of enlightenment, you become more and more free from suffering, and then ultimately you cease to exist, so you don't suffer, or anything else.
Is this what their practice of like yoga and other meditative type activities, is that what it's called?
Sure. Sure. Yeah. Exactly. Now I know with Hinduism, yoga is actually considered like a religious rite in some ways. I guess that's true on some level with Buddhism as well, because they practice yoga. Meditation also, I guess, is a religious experience for them as well. What about as far as divinity? What do Buddhists believe about God?
They believe there is no God, right?
Exactly.
But the weird thing about that is that there's somebody who judges you.
Well, they wouldn't believe that, actually. They think that...
How do you get your candle blown out?
I know. Who blows it out?
Yeah.
I have no idea. That's a good question. So the way I presented my question wasn't exactly right. They do believe in gods, right? But Buddha taught that these gods, in some way, share in the same experience as human beings, that they go through cycles of reincarnation. He would say that gods still have to approach a level of enlightenment, that they can still experience nirvana, which means they would also cease to exist. You know, the exact relationship between the gods and human beings, I don't really know. I don't know if they really know either. And my understanding is Buddha specifically taught against the idea of any type of ultimate divine anything behind the universe, which is slightly different from Hinduism. Some Hindus do believe in a singular, ultimate, all-powerful, personal God. And by personal, really that just means, a God that has a name, a God that talks to you and you can talk to him. Some Hindus believe that. Some Hindus don't. Some Hindus just believe in like a divine power, an impersonal divine power that manages the universe. But Buddha said no to all of that. So...
Right.
See, I read about that too, and I think that's another one of those situations where different Buddhists would approach that differently. See, some Buddhists say they worship Buddha, but then I read something else last night from a Buddhist that said they don't worship Buddha. They just respect him. When they bow to him, they're showing respect, and they offer these little sacrifices. It's just an act of respect. So to me, that just means worship. They don't want it to be considered idolatry, is what it comes down to. They don't want it to have the appearance that they're worshiping Buddha through a statue. And so they have explanations for how it's not idolatry, which that's just semantics, so it doesn't really matter. But yeah, I don't know. Here's the other interesting thing: did Buddha consider himself a god or not? No, he didn't. He specifically taught that he was just a human, just like anyone else. And Buddhism, the writings of Buddhism, even acknowledge that shortly after his death, he started to be venerated as one of the gods. So, to me, that's sort of undermining to the credibility of the religion.
The prayer wheels that they use, it seems like that they all do that in areas where the temples are statues of Buddha. Are they praying to Buddha, or just praying in general?
That's a good question. All of the above, I think. I think any and all of the above. See, that's one of the things about these Eastern religions. like when we talked about Hinduism, for example, does Hinduism consider itself the only legitimate religion? It doesn't, actually. A Hindu would say that Hinduism is the most direct path to salvation, whatever that actually is. They would say Hinduism is the most direct path. But, you know, things like Christianity or Judaism or Islam, they would say all of those are legitimate religions, just not as straight of a path as Hinduism. Which, of course, that doesn't make any sense at all because, you know, for even Islam, Christianity, Judaism, and Hinduism are all mutually exclusive. Apparently, you can be a Hindu and try to be some other religion at the same time, but in reality, they're mutually exclusive. We talked about how moral Buddhists tend to be on most levels. So unless there's something else from last week that you want to talk about... Oh, go ahead, Kevin.
Let me ask a question. I went here last week. What about prophets? You had spoken about this Buddha.
Yeah.
While he wasn't a god, but yet he became revered kind of as a god. It just reminded me of Muhammad. While they wouldn't consider him a god, he was a major prophet.
Right.
Are there prophets in Buddhism?
Sort of. That's actually a good introduction to what we'll talk about today with the holy text of Buddhism. So I'll just go ahead and mention it right now. Buddha taught that he was not the first Buddha, that there was hundreds of Buddhas before him and there would be hundreds of Buddhas after him. And he taught that ultimately what a Buddha is someone who achieves a degree or achieves the degree of enlightenment, and that allows them to communicate the teachings of life. Now, there's a specific word for it I'll have to find later. Yeah, that is right. Spell it again.
D-H-A-R-M-A.
Yes, that's right. Dharma.
Dharma.
Yeah, and Dharma is kind of like what we would call the Word of God, basically. We call it the Word of God. They call it Dharma. But they don't mean Word of God. What they mean, though, is like these eternal life truths. And they say that can come from anywhere, potentially, and any Buddha and any God, and then there's some other people it can eventually come from. So we'll talk about that. All right, so let's go ahead and get into the idea of the Buddhist holy text. And I'll be honest, sorting through the Buddhist holy text was more challenging for me than the Hindu holy text. And there's a lot of information, so we'll just talk about the main things that we would want to know in order to, you know, come to some conclusions about whether or not we would be interested in even entertaining the idea of Buddhism. So Buddha himself taught for about 45 years to a number of different audiences throughout Eastern Asia. And after he died, it was many, many centuries before anything was written down. In fact, it was about 400 years before anyone even attempted to write down any of the sayings of Buddha or any of the doctrines of Buddhism. But the doctrines of Buddhism did exist before they were actually written down. And again, this is something I think sort of jeopardizes the legitimacy of Buddhism. So Buddha taught in about 500 BC or so, around that area. And at that time, and this is really similar to Hinduism, at that time, nobody really cared to write this down. The Buddhists, it didn't matter to them whether the teachings of Buddha were written down or not. Everything was memorized to the extent that they were able to memorize it. And after Buddha died, there was this, apparently, they call it, it's called legendary. So I don't really know what legendary means here. Legendary in the fact that it didn't really happen, or legendary as in, you know, as if it was, you know, like some epic event. But in any case, the Buddhists would say that after Buddha died, that there was this legendary gathering of 500 followers of Buddha immediately after his death. And they gathered, apparently, for the purpose of standardizing the Buddhist teachings after Buddha was gone. So, you know, essentially it was a council of some form to make sure everyone understood these are the teachings of Buddha. And so everyone that, you know, had heard Buddha teaching, they all, you know, recited the stories that they had heard, the truths apparently that Buddha had taught them, and they established the teachings of Buddhism. Still, though, they didn't write it down. They just shared it with everyone, and they all apparently memorized it. And for at least 400 years, the teachings of Buddhism were just passed on through oral traditions. And one of the things I read says that the earliest Buddhist writings, you can tell that they came from oral traditions because the way that they're written down was probably the way that they were memorized. And so there's many, many repetitions, just tons and tons of repetitions so that people could memorize it. There's standardized phrases that are used throughout these writings. There's a lot of poetic rhythms. A lot of things that were intended to help people memorize and remember the teachings of Buddha. And one of the things, apparently, that you'll notice when you read through this is there's not a lot of structural cohesiveness or doctrinal cohesiveness. They just put things down so that you could remember it, even if it didn't necessarily make sense. And that kind of goes along with the idea of Hinduism. The value is not necessarily in the words, the meanings of the words, but in the recitation of these teachings. So about 400 years after his death, they did start to write down these teachings. And the texts of Buddhism are divided into three collections. They're known as the Tripitaka. Let me write some of this stuff on the word board just so you can see it. So basically, where's the light switch? So Tripitaka, whatever, if that's how you pronounce it. Anyways, it refers to three baskets, and it means three baskets because supposedly these original scrolls, when they were written, were literally stored in three baskets. As far as the organization of these, the first basket, and I won't write all this stuff on the board. This isn't even that important necessarily. I just want to tell you, though, so you've heard it. The first basket was called the Sutra Pitaka. And it consists of Buddha's actual discourses, so like his sermons is in basket number one. And so that includes like all of his stories, his anecdotes, any examples that he might have used to reflect his understanding of the path of enlightenment. And when you read through some of the Buddhist texts, especially this first basket, that's what it is lots and lots of stories. And we might even call it parables, really, because that's sort of what they sound like. It's these really long, elaborate stories, and ultimately it comes down to a Buddha trying to make some point about the nature of life. So that's basket number one. Basket number two is called the Vinaya Pitaka, and this contains guidelines for the monks, and it pertained primarily to their moral and social behavior, as well as some institutional guidelines for the temples. So basket number two is for the monks. And then basket number three, I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce it. In any case, basket number three was actually created many centuries later than the first two baskets. And this third group of writings, which I guess is considered today considered part of the Buddhist canon, apparently it was created in the same way that sort of some of the Hindu texts were created. Because remember, the later Hindu texts were written to make sense of the first Hindu text, because the first Hindu texts apparently don't make sense to anybody. And so they came up with these commentaries later to help explain it. Well, that's what basket number three is for Buddhism. It's a group of writings that were essentially created to clarify and establish some of the Buddhist philosophy. And apparently this third basket also helped to reorganize some of the teachings of the first two baskets in order to make more sense of them. Because apparently when they were initially organizing the teachings of Buddha, they didn't organize them based on subject or doctrine or anything like that. They organized the original teachings based on the length of the teaching and the style of the teaching. So if it was a poem, they put all the poems together. If it was a short writing, they put all the short writings together. And, you know, that's just more evidence that
understanding the doctrine really wasn't necessarily that important. The next thing I wanted to tell you about is the canonization of the Buddhist text. I'm going to write another word up here, and this kind of gets to what you were talking about, Kevin. Buddhavacana, I guess is how we'll say it. I don't know the real way of saying it. Buddhavacana is an important word in Buddhism, and this just means the word of Buddha. And very early in Buddhism, they agreed on a criteria for establishing Buddhavacana, which is the word of the Buddha. In other words, how do we decide what the word of the Buddha really is? And especially in early Buddhism, this Dharma, D-H-A-R-M-A, let me write that on the board too. Like we talked about already, it didn't necessarily have to come from Buddha himself. It apparently could come from other Buddhas, it could come from the disciples, it could come from these devas or other gods. There's a number of sources of Buddhavacana. And anyway, they have this system for determining whether or not something is actually inspired, wouldn't be the word, but whether something is actually legitimate Buddhist teachings. And we won't go into all of that. Any questions about this stuff so far? This is interesting, but ultimately what it comes down to is there's a lot of things about Buddhism that are extremely unreliable. And so let me just make a few points about that as far as the canonization. The Buddhist canon is not nearly as cohesive and standardized as the Christian canon is. For example, there's a Chinese Buddhist canon. It also happens to be accepted in Japan. And it contains other texts outside of these primary texts that we talked about. There's also the Tibetan Buddhist canon, which again includes other texts that wouldn't be included in the Chinese Buddhist canon. And then there's other sects of Buddhism that are in the same situation, where they have their own canon, their own group of writings. But what's interesting is what I read about Buddhism says that it's kind of the same situation, that nobody really cares. In Buddhism, they feel like they're free to explore these different formulations of the Buddhist canon, and apparently there's no real consequence to it, which doesn't make any sense to me at all, but I guess it makes sense to them. Another thing that's interesting is Buddhism believes that the Buddhist writings are written to be fluid, so that you can reinterpret them generation after generation depending on the circumstances. And so what Buddha actually says, apparently they believe can change. The meaning can change depending on the circumstance. That's all I had to say about the Buddhist text from the Buddhist perspective. What I want to do in our last few minutes is do something we probably should have done before we talked about the Hindu holy text and establish some specific guidelines for how we would judge the scriptures of another religion, including how we would judge the holy writings of our own religion. So any comments or questions about the Buddhist holy text before we get into that? Yeah, maybe they do. Did you read that they did?
No, I haven't. I don't know. That's why I was asking.
Yeah. There's a lot of things that go on at their temple. But to me, it sounded more like what went on during Mosaic Law. Not so much like what we do today as Christians.
So they read from the Holy Text, do you think?
Sure. Well, yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure. I don't want to give you an answer without being positive on it.
It's very ritualistic, isn't it?
Extremely. Yeah, extremely ritualistic.
I just wonder, how would a preacher, they don't call them preachers, but teachers get up and teach on this kind of holy text if it's so...
Yeah. And maybe they don't. Maybe they don't. I know one of the things I did read said that the monks...
monks and nuns, male and female, are there to get together in those temples. And their life every day is very much a service to Buddha, and, you know, studies towards the process of enlightenment. But as far as like communal activities, I'm not sure. I don't know if they have like assemblies like we do. So I do want to talk specifically about some apologetics, and hopefully this will be a little bit more interesting. And I feel like this is really important, because ultimately the reason we're studying this stuff is, you know, like we talked about in the beginning, in order to fairly criticize another religion, we have to understand it, I think. On some level, we have to understand it, at least understand it well enough that we can, you know, make a justifiable decision about the legitimacy of the religion. And also, we need to be able to communicate with other people about these religions, and not just to a Buddhist. You know, even though we're probably not going to meet a lot of Buddhists in the world, we will meet, and I'm sure all of us have met people like this, we are all going to meet people in the world, even Christians in the world, who say that any religion is potentially a legitimate religion. I'm sure you've heard that before, probably, even from a Christian. Someone who calls himself a Christian, that there are many paths to God, and even especially today now, many Christians are getting on this idea that, you know, other religions can be just as good as the Christian religion, which doesn't make any sense. But we need to understand those ideas and be able to present a good case for why these other religions aren't legitimate. And I ultimately feel like one of the ways that we can judge a religion well is based on the holy text. So let me ask you, and we've got about 10 minutes to talk about this. I feel like the holy text of a religion, and most religions would agree with this, the holy text of a religion is one of the ways that we can judge that religion, and maybe the way by which we can judge that religion, including the Christian religion. So what are some of the ways that you determine whether or not a holy text is legitimate? And just throw anything out there. And maybe think about ways that we prove the Bible. Think about that.
How old is it? Who wrote it? How can you prove that it's true?
Sure, exactly.
So, internal proofs, external proofs.
Yeah, internal proofs. And give me an example of what you mean by proof. Proof of what?
The things in the writings of the Bible are proved by history. Well, that would be external, maybe, too. Proved by history.
Yeah.
And the writings in the Bible agree with each other. They agree with themselves.
Right.
That's one aspect of internal.
Yeah. That's a good example.
Fulfilled prophecy.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. Now, for us, all of this makes perfect sense. To a Buddhist or to someone who is Hindu, that wouldn't make any sense at all. Because in Buddhism and Hinduism, as far as I can tell, they make no effort to justify the religion. The religion just is. They accept it as truth. They make no effort to validate the religion at all, including the holy text, which is a big problem to me. And why do you think Christians are so much more familiar with the process of proving a text?
Because ours can be proved.
Sure, yeah, ours can be proved. And we're challenged as well.
It says, you know, like the Bereans were more noble, that they searched the scriptures to see if what Paul was telling them was so.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, now apparently Buddha did teach, you know, don't take my word for it, figure this out for yourself, but how do you do that? By what measure do you decide if something is true or not?
That whole religion is based on the personal experience of one man.
Yeah.
You know, when you sat under the tree and all of that.
Yeah.
Basically.
Ultimately.
And there's religions today.
Yeah.
That is based on the experience of one man.
Well, and here's basically what Buddhism is. This would be the modern equivalent of Buddhism. It would be like me if I went and sat under a tree for a day and then came to you and said, I realized a lot of really important things about life. And then that was the religion. That's what Buddhism taught. That he sat under a tree, came to understand some important things about life, and then created a religion out of it. So let's talk about the holy text. I've got some specific criteria that I wrote down. Everything that you all said makes perfect sense, and they're right in line with some of the things that I wrote down here. The origin of the text, I think, is really important, and I'm thinking of two things: the circumstances of the writing and the authors of the text. So let me give you some examples as far as the circumstances of writing. When did Buddha teach again? What's the date we put on it? 500 BC. When were the writings created for Buddhism? About 100 BC. What's the problem with that? I know it's extremely obvious, but somebody explain it.
I can't remember stuff that happened yesterday.
Yeah, much less 400 years ago, right? And even if there's a tremendous amount of emphasis put on memorization, 400 years is a long time to just count on a human memory.
That's like passing down a story down a line of people.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and eventually you have Buddha being born out of his mom's armpit. You know what I mean? That's what happens. Literally, that's what happens over 400 years. So Christianity, though, compare that to Christianity. Jesus lived and died, to put a date on it, around 30 A.D. And at what point was the New Testament finished? Yeah, around 100 A.D. And when was it started? It's really hard to put a start date on it, but, you know, approximately when was it started?
60.
Yeah, 60. And, you know, how people come to that conclusion, I think, is a little bit debatable. As far as I'm concerned, the writings may have been in process almost immediately, but most people would say that it was as long as 20 years before the writings started. Why did it take so long for Christianity? I mean, to me, 20 years sounds like a long time until I think of Buddhism, and then it sounds like no time at all. But why in Christianity would they have waited 20 years to start putting this stuff into writing? Did they need the writings at first?
No.
No, why not? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they were speaking it. People were inspired, and they could hear this stuff on a daily basis. So the writings weren't as essential at first, but eventually, very quickly, the writings were created. Yes?
Now, we should be a little cautious, because there are portions of the Bible that are written a long time after the events happened.
And sure.
Particularly, the book of Genesis is a good example of that.
Yeah, maybe. Let me show you what I mean. I think you're probably right, but there's some people who would say, like, if you let me find an example. Okay, flip over to Genesis chapter 5. Now, I agree with you, Ben, but that brings up an important point that's worth making. See, this is one way that people criticize the Bible, is they say, you know, Moses in 1400 BC apparently was recording stuff that happened thousands of years earlier. Well, one of the things we know about Moses is, in many levels, he was as much a compiler as he was an author. And Genesis chapter 5 may be an example of that. Somebody just read the first verse.
This is the book of the genealogy of Adam. In the day that God created man, he made him in the likeness of God.
So, what am I talking about there? Yeah, it's called the book of the genealogy of Adam. And as you flip through Genesis, you'll find that a couple of different times where it's called the book of this, the book of that. And so what some people would say is that you're right, that ultimately Moses didn't compile this stuff and write some of it until many, many centuries later. But some of these writings may have existed extremely early in human history. So Genesis chapter 5, that might be an example of that. When it says the book of the genealogy of Adam, they may have been actually talking about a book that existed in ancient days that was ultimately incorporated into Genesis.
The Kings and Chronicles also talked about this. The books of the kings, or the,
sure,
book,
yeah,
the record of each of these regimes.
Yeah. Yeah, so the writings did exist earlier. But it is true, ultimately, this stuff wasn't recorded. It consolidated into a canon until later. We usually stop at 10 after, is that right? Okay, sorry we didn't get further today. Thanks for your comments and participation. So, just to give you an idea of what we'll do next week. Next week we'll finish this idea of evaluating a holy text. And then the next religion we're going to talk about is Mormonism, actually. I know we said we were talking about world religions, but I want things to be as relevant as possible. So the next thing we'll talk about is Mormonism. We'll take a 10-minute break.